This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasothi. Tandemic CEO Cal Jroff in the studio for his monthly show and joining us this time to talk to us about how social innovation can affect rural resilience is Ganesh Murin, who's the founder and CEO of Saora Industries, which is a social enterprise that provides solar-powered water filters for rural and marginalized communities. Ganesh will also be involved with the flood relief efforts later this month, so that'll be interesting to find out more. Welcome both of you to the show. How are you today, Cal?
Ganesh? Good, thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Well done. You know, Cal, you were on the cover of the Tatler magazine. In fact, if you walk through the little kiosk downstairs, you see your picture right in front of that little kiosk. And Ganesh, you were in the same issue as well. The focus was on social enterprises, was it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely thrilling that, you know, a magazine like Tatler would cover social enterprise.
I was surprised. Yeah, I was absolutely surprised. But I didn't get to read it, Cal. All I knew is your picture was right in front of it.
Yeah, so
with one of the Yo sisters,
Rebecca.
Rebecca Yo. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And what was that? What did that feel like?
Well, you know, I think. A couple of years ago, we spent time kind of talking to some high net worth individuals in Malaysia and trying to convince them, people who already had foundations in some cases, trying to convince them to, you know, direct more resources to social enterprise, saying, look, you're already giving money away. Why don't you give it to organizations that have the potential to be self-sustaining because they have some kind of revenue model behind them? And for a very long time, we just kind of ran into walls because people said, you know, had this view that either you have to give money away or you make money the most efficient way possible, but you don't do anything in between. Because that's suspicious or odd, or you shouldn't be, you know, making money out of doing charity work. And now I think that the opinion is starting to shift, and I think that getting this into magazines like Tatler, I wouldn't say it's mainstream, but I think that getting this into magazines like Tatler is really valuable and important for the movement.
So you think social enterprises is not mainstream yet, Ganesh, do you think?
I think social enterprises has a long way more to go. I think in Malaysia.
In what areas?
I think in terms of people being receptive over there's something, a company that can impact lives and also make money at the same time. So I think there's more coverage or more broad ways that social enterprises can leverage on. But I think there's a long way more to go in terms of social enterprise.
I think we run this risk in the sector of moving past the hype cycle, right? So there's always this kind of initial excitement about something new. It's like, wow, this is going to, you know, have a lot of impact. And then we actually need social entrepreneurs to catch up to the hype because it's still a very, you know, fragile emerging sector, I think. And so we need to have the sort of large, scalable, strong social enterprises to sort of be championing what it could be like to be a social enterprise, or what should this sector look like so that we can go forward with the mainstreaming of it.
I mean, we've been doing this show for how long now, Cal? 2 years?
Yeah.
Two years,
something
perhaps,
like that.
I hope that we've made some sort of impact, if not an impact, at least some sort of understanding as to what social enterprises really are. I remember doing the first couple of shows with you and thinking to myself, what's he going on about? You know, I'm trying to get my head around what he's actually trying to say, because you can't quite figure out anything other than the profit model, right? So here you're talking about people, profit, and planet, which everybody's, you know, going on about. But what does that really mean? What are some of your biggest challenges, Cal, as far as a social enterprise is concerned?
Well, I mean, I'll just take on that point about, you know, are we building awareness with the show? And I think yes. And the way I know is because I get random people, you know, messaging me on Facebook who've listened to the show and say, hey, this is a really interesting thing. Can I come and talk to you about my idea or whatnot? So it is working. So that's the good news. You know, what are some of the big challenges? I would say one of the biggest is access to talent. It's the same as, you know, private companies in a sense, but we have it harder because a lot of people don't look at work in the social sector as being a legitimate form of work. We have literally had parents come to our office with interns to make sure that we were a real legitimate company, you know. And so, you know, when we show up in the Star, when we show up, at, you know, in a magazine or something like that, that is tremendously helpful to say, yes, we are a real thing. You know, this isn't a scam.
Exactly. That must be quite difficult. What about funding, Ganesh? I mean, you've got a company now. It's called Saura Industries. We'll go back a little to how you brought this company to be. But in terms of funding, would you say that was the hardest challenge?
I think in terms of funds, I think people over here in Malaysia are still, what is the ROI of every ringgit or every anything that I put in, there must be a return to it. But the problem is they just don't see that, hey, you know, the payback period can be long, but then what am I doing contributing to make a differentiating factor in other people's lives? So what happened is they just look at the short-term gains of it. So in terms of funding, there are a couple of people who has come forward at the moment. Some people, for example, high net worth individuals who has really come forward and say, hey, you know, I would like to be part of this. How can I be part of this? We had a couple of funders come in as well. So I think some people are seeing the light, starting to see the light and say, hey, you know, I would like to be part of a social enterprise. Yeah.
So when you say investors, there will be a return at some stage. Is that what you're saying? It's just that it's not going to be over a short period of time.
Yep. I think in terms of return, you can. There's two parts of the return. If it's you want to look at the social return of it, some people come in and say, hey, you know, I'll just put in money. I'm not looking anything forward. Once I put in money, I know that, you know, there's probability I'm never going to get it.
Yep.
And then they say, hey, you know, but at least I know that someone's life has been changed by that amount of money. Some people come in and say, I'll place in the money, but then, you know, I won't treat it like a typical investment, but I'll look at it as a social investment. So the payback period, the payback terms will be really different compared to the typical ones.
And do you have to report to them? I mean, every year, how you're doing? How do you do that?
The current investors or the current funders that we have at the moment, I don't know, they treat it as an investment because I see them six months once. For them, it's like, hi.
Investment, you know? In what? Financial or?
In financial.
Social? Okay.
Yeah, and they're like, hey, I put in money. And every time I send them emails that, hey, you know, we've just done this project. And every email that I get back, hey, good job, carry on. And if sometimes when I tell them that, hey, I'm facing this problem, and then they say that, good job, carry on. So I don't think so. They are really reading my emails. Yeah.
But do you meet them every year? Do you have like a annual general meeting?
Yes, since it's a official company, we do have our AGM. But then in terms now, they are much more involved because the company is really moving fast as well. So they are much more putting in their contacts, their money, their financial, and also their network throughout the region to help us grow. Yeah.
Okay. When you talk about or when you say rural resilience, what does that mean?
I think that's a question that Carl should take, because Carl is the one who has taught me about social enterprise.
You made up the word.
No. It's an absolutely real word. But, you know, I think we're most familiar with resilience when it comes to things like children and education. And we think about, you know, there are these kids who have gone through really terrible times, and then they come out, you know, top scholar and things like that. And then there are kids who have had, you know, all of the things that they've ever needed and then yet don't do well. And so we think about this question about these kids who've gone through these tough times. Well, they have resilience, right? They're able to bounce back from situations. And rural resilience is really the same kind of thing but applied to community. So when we think about a natural disaster, floods, for example, hitting a rural community, how well does the community respond? And there are very big differences. So for example, when we look at the earthquake that hit Haiti, it wasn't actually a terribly strong earthquake. When you know, San Francisco has been hit by much stronger earthquakes, and yet so many people died and lost their homes in it. And why is that? Because Haiti wasn't a particularly resilient country, because they weren't prepared for it, because they didn't have the systems in place to do it. I kind of think of it also as there's this movie with Justin Timberlake called Time's Up. Mm-hmm. And you turn 25 and there's a countdown timer that appears on your arm about how much time you have left in your life. And so the city is divided in two. And one side of the city, everyone has 24 hours left. And they continuously work at the factory to get 24 hours more and so on and so forth. But if for one reason you're sick one day, you know, you might end up with 12 hours or 5 hours left and you might run out of money, right? And so some groups of people don't have the right kinds of reserves in place, the right kinds of situations that enable them to be resilient from disasters, you know, outbreaks of disease and things like that.
So you have gone into something called rural resilience through one of your inventions or innovations, would I call it, Ganesh? But it all started when you went on a backpacking trip in India when you bumped into a six-year-old girl. You want to just share that story with me?
I backpacked in India. I think it was in 2013, if I'm not mistaken. So I backpacked and I saw the entire water crisis that was happening there. And when I went to India, and then my mom kept on calling me from Malaysia and say, hey, you know, drink water bottles that is not, you know, opened. You know, it has to have like a label on it, proper label, and has to come from a renowned brand because she's really concerned about the water. But then what happened is...
I know that brand. Bisleri, isn't it? Yeah. Everybody goes to India from Malaysia. It's like nothing but Bisleri. Sorry, go ahead.
And I was seeing the kids over there by the slums drinking water and bathing in the same river and even taking, doing their daily chores and over there. But then I came back to Malaysia and said, hey, you know, I'm being an engineer. I'm going to solve the world's greatest problem, and I'm going to solve India's 1 billion people problem. And then I was, I did a bit of driving around in Negeri Sembilan and all those, trying to visit a few kampongs. Then I realized that I visited this kampong, which is 1 hour just away from KL. 180 families was living there, and they still get water from. They have like a water tank. They wait for the rain. And then I met this beautiful girl, 6 year old, and she has like huge ambitions. She wanted to be a veterinarian, and but I spoke to the mom, and she was telling me that, hey, you know, she suffers diarrhea 6 times a week. She doesn't go to school because her hairs were falling because of diarrhea. She had other
and this
disease.
Is the kampong, which is 1 hour away from KL.
Yeah, from KL. Okay. Yes, and so when I visited, then I said, hey, you know, why do I have to go to India to solve a huge problem? The problem is just at my doorstep. It's just 1 hour away from KL. And I came back and said to my lecturers in my final year degree, I said, hey, you know, I want to design this. And they said, yeah, just go ahead. So that was my final year project in my university.
And what is this? It's a solar-powered water purification system. Yes. We'll come back and find out a little bit more up next. We have Kel Joff and Ganesh Murran in the studio with us, speaking to us about rural resilience. If you have a question for them, then phone lines are open, 803-77109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000.
Break from mediocrity. BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon. It's Live and Learn, and I'm Mira Sivasodhi. Kel Joff, CEO and founder of Tendemic, in the studio with us, together with Ganesh Murran, who's the founder and CEO of Saura Industries. We're discussing rural resilience. Ganesh has actually come up with a solar-powered water purification system, invention of his own, actually, and gone into villages to help, help them with the water issues. Ganesh, just to pick up on what you were telling us, the story of that six-year-old girl, she passed away in the end.
Yes, I finished my entire prototype, and then I came back, and then I found out that she actually passed away. And it was quite, because I was really disappointed with myself, because I think it was entirely built for her. I tried to say, hey, you know, I want to change your life. I promised her. I said, I'm going to come back. And then she knew, yeah.
But were you sure the problem was actually the lack of clean water?
Because the problem is the water source that I saw, it has the previous time I went there and saw, because I went visited every month. And I saw there was a dead cat in it, in the tank, water tank, and they never really cleaned it up. And it was much more on the awareness of clean drinking water, and also there wasn't a system put into place to give them clean drinking water.
Do you think this problem of the lack of clean water is a big problem here in Malaysia?
I think it's quite huge. If it's 1 hour away from KL, then there's certain places where, even now at the moment, we are in Sarawak. So I think if you drive down an hour away from Sarawak, there is you can find thousands of, maybe a couple of thousands of families who's already. Last month, we got a approach by one of the communities saying that 6 children just got admitted in the Miri Hospital because of, I think it was some...
E. coli, salmonella.
Yes, in the water source, because I think they have animal farm beside, so the
waste.
Yeah, the waste from the animal farm goes into the water, and then they consume it. So it's quite sad, because these people, they don't have the awareness. Yeah.
Okay. So, Cal, do you think safe drinking water and poverty, what's the link really? Does it always have to be the marginalized who are affected by the lack of clean water?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, especially during disaster situations. So
we don't have a disaster.
Well, there are floods that happen every once in a while. Yes. On the East Coast. You know, and the people who can get out of those situations are the people who own boats, who have the money to do so. And then, you know, last year, someone last week was telling me their organization sent in a helicopter with aid that was intended for one group, but they were basically surrounded and by villagers who had been cut off for 7 days and had run out of food and water. And so you need ways to get a lot. It's a huge part of really resilience to be able to access clean drinking water. Now, when you think about how do we get water in our homes in the first place, well, one is if we live in a city, we get piped water, mm-hmm. right? If we're in a rural area, we might get it from a well. And those are the main sources of safe drinking water. But if you look at, you know, the construction of homes in a lot of rural areas, longhouses and how they can be set up and moved in some cases in places like East Malaysia and rural peninsular Malaysia, these are not places where it's that easy to ship in the equipment to, you know, drill a well and do all of the things that you would need to do to get proper drinking water.
Well, it says a lot about how we value our water source in the first place, isn't it? We're talking about rivers and where, you know, water originates from. I mean, we don't really care. I mean, it's clearing of trees going on and as you said, pollution from factories. I mean, we're not really looking after our water, where the water comes from in the first place. You want to tell me a bit about the prototype and the solar-powered water purification system?
Traditionally, what happens is typically, the government spends a lot of money to actually build in the entire infrastructure to deliver these like pipings and all those. But what we do is we basically use Mother Nature. She picks up the water for free, and then she brings it to these villages and dumps it for free. And it flows through these villages for generations. They've been living nearby rivers, ponds, and wells. So what we do is basically the prototype picks up any raw water. The water that comes to homes in urban areas is already coming in at quite a good quality. But this prototype basically purifies any sort of raw water into clean drinking water. And as you can see, it is solar powered. So basically the solar power, we have a panel, solar panel and a battery. So it uses a pump to push through water through 7 mediums of purification. And why a battery was put into place is because when we visited a few villages in Sarawak, they had to use kerosene lamps. And when they used kerosene lamps, the fumes from it was really bad for their health as well. So what we had is, let's do a battery system, and also it could power up 2 light bulbs at the same time. So it also provides electricity at the same time at night, and during the day, it also purifies water. And it does around 7 litres a minute, so it's quite fast. Yes,
that's not bad.
Yeah, I think 7 liters. I think it's one thing is not good about engineers is we keep on trying, because I'm trying to push to 10 liters and the sales guy is like, no, there's even the urban households, 10 liters doesn't come out from your tap. It's really fast. So we're trying to...
I'm just thinking, is it big? Is it bulky? What's stopping you from commercializing and selling it to all of us?
I think the urban areas is not something that we would cater to in the long run. I think because the water filters company over here is just super saturated. We did a study, the penetration rate would just be 90% to 95%. It wouldn't be worthwhile to actually compete here, because I think we're just starting off, and until we reach a huge order or huge like many economies of scale, where if there's a huge order, then we could drive the cost down. But till we hit that number, I don't think we can actually compete with the huge players over here.
Thinking it might be less costly, actually.
It is less costly. Honestly speaking, I think if you look at it, water purification companies, they make a huge ton of money. I think even at my house, even a system costs around 6,000 ringgit. But our system basically is just a fraction of that cost. And also it provides electricity. I think rather than providing water purification, I think we're just trying to change the lifestyle and impact their life in a wholesome way.
And this system can turn feces and urine into drinking water?
Yes.
So how different is this from new water in Singapore, for an example?
I think the thing is, new water basically uses the reverse osmosis. The process is basically, when you use an RO process, 50% of the water is becomes wastewater. Only 50% of the water goes through the system. And but ours is basically 99.9% yield of the water that goes through. So we try to make it efficient. And also, ours basically can also purify water without electricity, but the addition of electricity is just to make it much more efficient.
Of course. And is this technology patented?
We are going through the patent process at the moment. It's going to take like 3 years for a global patent.
What happens in the meanwhile, Cal? I mean, do you see many companies like Ganesh's struggling with patent issues?
Patent
because
is...
Because it's open for copying, right? And if it costs less, anyone can go out and do it.
Yeah, there are kind of two angles to this. Ganesh's social enterprise, I would say, is special because we have very few social enterprises here in Malaysia that have unique technology products, right? We have social enterprises with new business models, with maybe, you know, that target different kind of delivery groups or beneficiaries, but actual technology, you know, science-based social enterprises, if you will, very few of them. And so the patent process is very difficult and requires a lot of money to go through. But it doesn't necessarily entirely protect you either. And so what we've seen with other social enterprises globally is that branding is super important. So as an example, in Tanzania, A to Z Bed Nets is a company that produces special bed nets that protect families against malaria, and they've been very successful because they have put very strong branding behind their bed nets. And so people from underprivileged areas recognize these are actually higher quality bed nets. And some people think that, you know, people who are from sort of lower socioeconomic backgrounds who don't have as much money don't care about brand. It's not true at all. Mm-hmm. Brand is a very important determinant of whether I'm going for a quality product or whether I'm going for a cheap imitation or something like that.
Okay. So does Ganesh have a long way to go as far as patenting? 3 years is a long time, Cal.
3 years is a long time, but if I'm not mistaken, Ganesh, you don't need to wait to get your patent to start production and everything. It's if you look at the back of a lot of products, it'll say like patent pending, you know, and it's because they've shipped the product before they've actually fully gotten all of the papers in.
Okay. And this is a triple bottom line enterprise, Saora. Triple bottom line meaning you're looking at people, planet and profits. I always wondered, what does your balance sheet look like?
I think from the start...
Or your P&L for that matter. I mean, what is a social cost? What's an environmental cost? How do you put that all in?
It's just been like a year since we started off.
He's the disclaimer first before I go on.
And And I think that the thing is we try to put people always the first part of it. I think the people that have come on board, we just hired a new person who's used to be an MNC regional director graduated from Harvard. But then I think these people who are all joining us coming in on the same purpose to bring in water to these poor people. And I think thinking about that, I think from the start, it's all about the people. We haven't really touched the profit part yet. I think when we do, I'll do.
I'm more interested in the planet part.
I think in terms of planet, like I said, if usually what they do is basically have huge piping to actually deliver this. And if you're going to do that in Sarawak, whereby even traveling to a village takes 2 days, it's going to ruin the entire infrastructure.
Or plastic water bottles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 Yeah. How do you take into account the cost that, you know, isn't tangible?
So the typical approach for a triple bottom line organization is something called SROI, Social Return on Investment. And what it looks at is what's the cost of delivering this environmental benefit or this social benefit if we had to pay for it, right? So for example, what would be the cost of delivering clean water to these villagers? That could be one way of looking at it. Or what's the cost of the health challenges that they will have? What's the benefit in terms of increased income over their lives that they will have because kids were able to go to school due to less sickness?
Isn't that hard to quantify, Cal?
It's estimate. So typically there are different kinds of social return on investment. So typically it's estimated going forward. We see a lot of that. It is a guesstimate at best, I would say, in many cases. Sometimes it's done looking backwards. So sometimes we can actually account for cost savings and we can look backwards. Usually it's longer than a year period that we need to actually collect enough data to find out, though.
Okay. And this project is going ahead in Sarawak, am I correct, Ganesh?
Yes.
How's it been? 1 year, you said?
We just started implementing. I think the first 6 months after the company was started off, we were waiting for funds to come in because it was from a CSR fund. But then we are serving at the moment around 450 people in Sarawak. I think by first quarter next year, we'll be reaching 1,000. And I mean, what happened was two to three weeks ago when we provide electricity and water together, then we had someone added me on Facebook, basically, and then she posted on my wall and saying, hey, because you got water now, we got your system, I just created a Facebook account, I got myself a mobile phone, and everyone is happy now. And I mean, we didn't really thought about the impact until, wow, the impact has just gone so far. Mm-hmm. We didn't really thought she would be the first thing they went and got for themselves was a mobile phone and got a Facebook account, and they're so connected now. So we didn't really thought that far, but I think after this, there's more to go.
Fantastic. Yeah. And how have the both of you been working together, Cal?
I think Carl has been a really strong supporter from the start, I would say. Carl, I think we met two and a half years ago. Carl would probably be the first, one of the very first person who taught me how to pitch. So in the very start, I had like a huge 30 minutes to an hour story to tell. But Carl is like, hey, you know, you just got to do it in 2 minutes. So we sat down and he worked since that day. I think we worked really close. He has been mentoring me as well. So I think what he has been doing is, I think it's much more on the mindset shift that he has brought me. I think he's introduced like amazing people along the way who's also really supportive of the project now. So I think Carl has been the very, I think once, the thing is when you have an idea, you want to do something, and your idea is just very crazy and no one wants to listen to you, that's where Carl comes in and listens to you.
Do you think it was worse because you're very young?
Yes, I guess so. One part of it, but I think...
Convincing investors. How did you do that?
I just went in. I said, hey, you know, I'm young. I'm 22. I'm going to make some mistakes along the way. I need your guidance. I usually tell the investors, I mean, what everyone looks at investors is much more like a money bag rather than a person itself. And you got to understand they are human as well. And they too have feelings and they too want to be part in something to give back to these people. And that's the problem. I think all of us, some of us really look them as, hey, you know, that's a cash cow walking. But then what you got to do is say, hey, you know, I don't need, usually I speak to investors. I spoke to an investor 2 years ago and he's still mentoring and now he's putting in some financial money into it. But then I tell them and they start, hey, you know, I don't need your money. I just need your advice on how to grow a great company. And I want to make my own money. And I mean, having money is good, but I don't want your money because it's your earned money.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really strong way to actually go about it because you got to treat them as humans as well.
Yep. You know, Cal, Ganesh said cash cow just now. If Ganesh does find the opportunity to really, you know, make money from this, what's the journey from moving from a social enterprise to, you know, a full-fledged non-social enterprise?
Well, I hope that, you know, people who start social enterprises stay as social enterprises in the sense that social mission, it remains a North Star in their organization. It's a big challenge, though. I mean, we all know what happened to Body Shop, right? Body Shop became a public listed company. They kicked out the founder, who was really the heart of the organization. And I mean, today I think it's still a socially meaningful organization, but it is not a social enterprise, I think, in the same sense that it used to be. And so that's why in my view, it's so important to invest in people and scale, and so the founder plays a very important role. Founders play a very important role in retaining the culture and the ethics around the company, and then they play a role in sort of scaling that culture as the organization becomes larger. That's the tough part, right? Once you're a 100-person company, once you're a 1,000-person organization, how do you ensure that your primary mission is still to help people in a way that's sustainable?
Okay, and Ganesh, are you working with government?
At the moment, we are trying to work closely with the government. I hope they will work closely with us as well on their point of view. But the thing is, I think everyone has their interest to it. But I think what we try to do is basically say, hey, you know, everyone, we can achieve a common goal by working together. We work with the Sarawak state government very closely and also the federal government. Okay. And Ministry of Finance has basically been a really strong supporter of ours as well.
Okay. And how will you – you're going to be assisting doing flood relief work next month?
I think we just got a project to test out our systems in Kelantan. It was funded by the Hong Leong Foundation. So basically, they've come forward and say, hey, you know, we'll try out the systems. A couple of folks who's going to come and check out the system while it's in place as well. So we are placing in around 20 points where people can purify water and also drink it on the spot itself.
Which part of this is the east coast of the peninsula?
We have not really identified the places yet, because I think what we do is we are much more of a technology provider, and then we have the foundation which basically selects the place that he has to go to. They haven't really come back to us on the place yet.
Okay, so going forward, what's in store for Saura?
I think basically Saura Industries, is an industries, so I think it have huge vision. I think the next would be to look into sanitation. I think to actually get a person above a poverty line, I think the entire household income has to be higher. Health wise, they have to be better. Education has to be provided. I think we try to go into those spaces. I think that's why we work with Carl and say, hey, in terms of education, how can we put together something? Because you don't really need to teach PowerPoint or Microsoft Word to a rural fisherman. They need to know how to fish better. A farmer needs to know how to farm better. So I think we have to give necessary help at the necessary times. So at the moment, I think water and electricity is really important. The next we are looking is into sanitation.
Okay. And do you need the public help in any way?
I think the public definitely has to be really supportive on what we do. I think we do need volunteers to come and help us out in installing systems in these rural areas. We need people to come forward and become advocate of saying, hey, you know, it's not being an advocate of a brand, but being advocates of saying, these people deserve clean water as well. It's much more of a fundamental right. It's not a luxury. Yeah. So we hope everyone will be supportive of the entire project itself.
Fantastic. Kel, your message on rural resilience.
Well, so we know that poverty plays a very important role in distinguishing between what are the communities that, when disaster strikes, suffer and have a great amount of death, and what are the ones that don't. We don't have, when floods hit KL, we don't have, you know, townships that haven't had food for 7 days. And we also know that many natural disasters can't be avoided. And so instead of working and focusing so much money and effort on disaster sort of recovery, what if we spent more on building resilience for communities? What if we worked on the issue of poverty rather than simply trying to come back, you know, in these so-called crises, which actually happen every year? And I don't think we can humanly or realistically call crises anymore. Instead, let's work on the fundamental factors that make these communities resilient and help them get through these hard times.
Fantastic. All the best, Ganesh. And thank you, gentlemen,
thank
for
you.
Joining me today. Kel Joff, CEO of Tendamic, and Ganesh Murin, the founder and CEO of Saura Industries, talking to us about rural resilience on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.